I'm Jackie Leiden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. We'll jump into the pages of the Washington Post magazine and talk to a former football coach about using sports to find redemption. That's coming up. But first, to the Super Bowl, or actually the Super Bowl ads. Advertisers spent about $3.5 million per 30 seconds to do their best to wow viewers, and they might have gotten their money's worth. More than 100 million people tuned in. Joining me to talk about which ads scored and which fumbled are Eric Deggans. He's the TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. And also with us is Makisha Madden-Toby. She's the TV critic and entertainment writer for the Detroit News. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, last night seemed to be about babies, cars, and dogs, and some really great blasts from the past.
He bought it. How can I handle work on a day like today? One of the worst performances of my career, and he never doubted it for a second. Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please? I've got a lot to do today.
Roderick.
Of course, that was Matthew Broderick. He was the star of the 1986 movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which this ad was playing off of course. But it wasn't a surprise to a lot of people because about half of the Super Bowl ads this year were released on YouTube a few days early. Makisha Madden-Toby, why did advertisers do this?
I think to create buzz, but in a way it sort of made everything anticlimactic. It just felt, I don't know, part of the fun of seeing Super Bowl ads is being surprised by what you see. And there was no element of surprise if you saw it online. And that takes away some from the experience, I think.
Does it make the ads less effective, in your opinion?
I think they're just as effective. It's just they're not as much fun, actually. And maybe in that way, I guess they aren't as effective if you look at it like that. If part of the fun is watching Super Bowl ads and people anticipating what they're going to see, and you take away some of the anticipation, I don't know if you remember the ad more. You do remember the product, but in that way they get their desired result. But in terms of what people are talking about, people were already talking about Matthew Broderick all last week. They're not going to be talking about him tomorrow again unless they talk about how much they didn't like it or how much it wasn't as good maybe the second time around.
Yeah, I would point out that I think they did it because the Volkswagen ad from last year featuring the kid who was dressed like Darth Vader was so popular. That ad was released early, and it became a viral hit even after the Super Bowl. But TiVo, the company that makes a digital video recorder that a lot of people use, released its figures on Super Bowl ads. And the most engaged ads, the ads that people watched the most, were the ones that were not released early. So I think they did pay a price this time.
Interesting. Well, Doritos ads are usually real crowd pleasers, and this year wasn't any different. I'd play a clip, but it's a lot of silence. It's more about what wasn't said. And so, Eric, you said that this was one of your favorite ads at the Tampa Bay Times. Tell listeners about the Great Dane spot for those who didn't see it.
Sure. This is a great Dorito. Doritos had a bunch of great ads in the Super Bowl, but this was the best one. This is a guy sort of messing around in his yard. He notices a dog that seems to be covering up a collar that might have belonged to an animal. And then he looks up and he sees a poster that shows that it's the collar that belongs to a cat that's been missing. And the dog comes over and looks him in the face and gives him a bag of Doritos with a little note that says, "You didn't see nothing." And then the end of the ad, this guy's presumably his wife is asking about the cat. And the dog is outside his patio with another bag of Doritos waiting to bribe him again. And, it's funny on one level. It was TiVo's most popular, most engaged ad as well. And a lot of people have been talking about it today. But it also sort of, I think, reveals one trend that we saw in Super Bowl ads. A lot of them were dark. A lot of them had dark undertones. It's funny on one level, but on another level, it's funny because this dog killed a cat. So, there's some other ads. There's an ad that evoked the apocalypse. There was an ad where a bunch of vampires got eliminated. There's an ad where a kid was in a pool, and it's implied that he may have relieved himself in it. There were a lot of ads that pushed the boundaries of a sort of dark humor this time around.
That's interesting. You know, I hadn't really thought about it that way, but when you add them all up, you're absolutely right. I guess all that football action kind of got in the way. What do you think, Makisha? Do you agree that there was sort of a dark, edgy undertone?
I didn't look at it as dark and edgy. Maybe I'm too dark and edgy or something. I don't know. But I really...
And it's this normal was, for you.
I know. I'm sitting here listening to him, and I'm like, oh, I like that one, too. Yeah, I like that one. I love the Audi ad with the vampires. I love the apocalyptic commercial because Chevy takes a dig at Ford. I think I was more focused on that. And I also was more focused on those ads because... Interestingly enough, two things happened in terms of trends with those ads that Eric mentioned that happened to have dark undertones, with the exception, of course, of the Doritos ad. But the Audi ad with the vampires, the ad with the apocalypse with the Chevy, both are auto ads. And I felt like the automakers had a better selection and better offering of ads this year than the other companies, because they didn't use celebrities or dogs. And I
well,
like
I would,
that.
I would say that one of the most effective ads was from an automaker, and it did feature a celebrity. It was Clint Eastwood's ad for Chrysler and Dodge, where we hear his rough-edged voice sort of delivering this speech that is sort of perking up America. It's basically sort of a classic motivational speech that you might hear at halftime, and he says, you know, it's halftime in America, and you got to pay attention because, you know, Dirty Harry's telling you this, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And a very dark landscape. You know, we see a Detroit that is obviously on the ropes, but coming back.
Eric, let's just throw to that for a moment.
Sure.
We'll throw to the clip.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
This country can't be knocked out with one punch. We get right back up again, and when we do, the world's going to hear the roar of our engines. Yeah, it's halftime America, and our second half's about to begin.
Now, I think the buzz is that was one of the most effective ads of the whole game.
Now, you just knew he was going to say, make my day right after that. Right? but what I and he did mix his metaphor, but who cares because it's Dirty Harry, right? But what's great about that, too, is that it's also a callback to a very effective ad from last year in which Eminem was driving through Detroit and his hit Lose Yourself was playing in the background. So a shout out to an earlier ad, a little bit of a dark metaphor. It also felt a little bit like a political speech in a way.
I was going to ask you. I mean, I know you guys are, entertainment TV, but a lot of people are saying that it seemed like an Obama campaign ad.
If I was Obama, I would take the soundtrack from that ad and it would be my next campaign commercial.
Well, and I loved how he said, and it's not about, I mean, we shouldn't get divided by these types of things. And then they show the White House. And I don't know. I loved it. And I don't know about the other, I mean, Jerry Seinfeld and all that and Jay Leno and all those people. For some reason, those annoyed me, even John Stamos to some extent, even though that was kind of funny. But mm-hmm. It didn't bother me that Clint Eastwood was in his ad, even if he was one of the many celebrities, because he's sort of an icon. And as I said in my review, if Detroit had a voice and a face, it would be his. So grizzled but wonderful and loved. And I love him, and I love the ad.
All right. We have to go to the halftime show. Madonna coming in, as Cleopatra, blaze of glory. Let's have a quick listen to that. So reviews have really been mixed for this one. Eric Deggans, was it a score or a fumble, do you think?
I thought it was the world's best karaoke competition ever. you hear that? The audio sounded like the record.
Yeah.
She wasn't really singing. The staging was amazing. The visuals were amazing. What I thought was the most interesting thing was that the rapper M.I.A., totally stole Madonna's thunder by flipping off the audience briefly during her performance. And everybody has been talking about that and NBC's apology and NBC sort of blaming the NFL for producing the show and the NFL saying, well, NBC was slow in blurring out the image. Everybody's talking about that. And not so many people are talking about Madonna's wonderful performance, athletic performance as a 53-year-old who can still do cartwheels.
Really? Not so many people? I seem to hear something about that. What do you think, Makisha? Did she really moved? I saw that on Facebook, too.
She really moved, and then it looked like right before the end that she was tired. She looked like she needed a Gatorade. She needed a big Gatorade.
Okay. Vogue.
And she was like, ooh, girl. If I get my A, somebody relieve me. I need to sit down.
If I get to say anything about that, the puff of smoke thing at the end where she just disappears, I have to say I kind of laughed.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she passed out. That's why they probably took
You didn't see that little stretcher, you know, running out from behind. I give it up. It was wonderful, but I am really getting tired of Super Bowl halftime performers who don't sing. Prince and Bruce Springsteen and Tom Petty and The Who all proved that you can go onto that arena, you can sing and perform live, and you can be amazing. So why not do it? I wanted to see, you know, dancers gyrating to a pre-recorded track, I would put in an old Solid Gold episode.
Maybe next year. We have to wrap it up ourselves. Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times, and he joined us from their newsroom. And Makisha Madden-Toby, TV critic and entertainment writer for the Detroit News, and she joined us from NPR's Bureau in Culver City, California. And thank you both for your time.
Thank you, Jackie.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Jesus is making a huge splash on YouTube. He's the subject of a video called Why I Hate Religion But Love Jesus, that's been viewed more than 18 million times in just a few weeks. As NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports, some see YouTube as a new pulpit for the millennial generation.
The video is spare, a young man dressed in leather jacket and jeans looking into the camera. Then 22-year-old Jefferson Bethke, a church-going Christian and rap artist, voices what much of his generation is thinking.
What if I told you Jesus came to abolish religion? What if I told you voting Republican really wasn't his mission? What if I told you Republican doesn't automatically mean Christian, and just because you call some people blind doesn't automatically give you vision?
Bethke takes apart religion and religious people for what he calls their hypocrisy, for building churches but not feeding the poor, for caring more about rules than about grace.
Now back to the point, one thing is vital to mention, how Jesus and religion are on opposite spectrums. See, one's the work of God, but one's a man-made invention. See, one is the cure, but the other's the infection.
Overnight, Bethke's video garnered 2 million views. The next day, 4 million.
I was like glad that the message I am so passionate about was out there. But at the same time, I was like, oh, geez, I don't even want to go to my Gmail and see how many are going to be in the inbox now, you know?
With the popularity came some criticism.
Yeah, I got a ton of pushback.
From people who noted that Jesus did not hate religion, he was an observant Jew, and that the church has been at the forefront of helping the poor. But Bethke, who graduated from college last year, says his Christian friends feel the same way. The church is losing Jesus amid rules and partisan politics. He believes that's why his video went viral.
I think it was the perfect, succinct example of the division between my generation and the older generation. And since it was such on a national stage with YouTube, I think it finally gave everyone a reason to talk about it.
And talk they did. 200 people made videos in response. And now more than 18 million people have viewed it. Not bad for a video about religion, or anything else for that matter.
No one gets 17 or 18 million hits.
Kevin Alaka is YouTube's trends manager. He says only music videos do this well. You can never predict what will go viral, Alaka says, but Bethke's video has a couple of things in common with other YouTube hits.
They're very unique and engaging, but also they're just very shareable. And it's not just that you want to just share this with someone else and say, hey, check this out. It's you say, hey, I want you to watch this, and then I want to talk about it with you.
Bethke's video makes it clear. Young people not only think differently about their faith, they absorb it differently. Journalist Kathleen Falsani says she saw that when she visited a Sunday school class. The teenagers were rowdy, talking over each other and the teacher. But when the teacher played Bethke's video,
you could have heard a pin drop. They were absolutely rapt. They were focused. And then when it was done, they had really good questions to ask. They had excellent feedback.
Falsani, who heads up New Media for Sojourners, a progressive Christian organization, says video Christianity is not a bad thing. It's a spiritual thing.
I think the medium is the way that, you know, in my world, I'm an evangelical Christian, that I think the Holy Spirit is using to speak to children's hearts.
And to adults. She's seeing more videos about religion from all kinds of people, trying to sell their version of Christianity to others inside and outside of the church. Here's Tea Party Jesus, a video produced by liberal Christians.
When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the hill, and his disciples gathered around him.
In the South Park-like animation, Jesus is surrounded by his followers, including Glenn Beck, Michelle Bachman, Newt Gingrich, and Rush Limbaugh. He delivers a sermon using lines from speeches and posters at Tea Party rallies.
Blessed are the meek in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for lower taxes, for their pockets will be filled.
Liberals are relative newcomers to YouTube Christianity, a path pioneered in part by Molotov Mitchell. Mitchell is a martial arts teacher and rising star among religious conservatives. His video challenging Barack Obama's birth certificate drew 4.5 million viewers. His short videos are highly produced, always caustic and provocative.
Is it unfair to use gay in a negative way? I mean, do we have to automatically respect or even give special rights to them based on who they have sex with?
Another favorite target? Muslims.
It's not that most Muslims are less intelligent. They're just poorly educated. Islam violently opposes critical thinking, and that's why most Muslims have never even read a Quran.
In fact, Muslim Americans are just as likely to have a college degree as other Americans. Mitchell is deliberately offensive, but he has growing influence, attracting attention and donations. He says he's only following Jesus' example.
A lot of people have this picture of Jesus as this emaciated homosexual guy with blonde highlights in his hair, and he would never harm a fly, when really Jesus was far more balanced and righteous than that. Of course, he was loving and he was compassionate, but at the same time, he also was a man and he would fight.
Something Mitchell says Christian pastors, whom he calls cowards, have failed to do. So now,
young people are looking for answers elsewhere. And I think that our success has largely been because I don't pull any punches. I tell it like it is.
One thing is clear. Internet videos are changing Christianity, says David Kinneman. He's president of the Barna Group and has surveyed young Christians extensively. He says creating videos is as natural as breathing for young people, so forget about seminary. YouTube allows a martial arts teacher like Mitchell or a recent college graduate like Jefferson Bethke to broadcast their interpretation of Christianity to the world.
Anyone could be a theologian as long as you're persuasive, able to create a great internet video, and the luck of the draw that your video gets selected out of the thousands that are uploaded.
Kinneman says YouTube is creating a revolution akin to the printing press, which brought the Bible to every household. Overall, that's a good thing for religion.
But is there a possibility that this is going to actually create a sort of a new breed of people that are great at performance but light on theology? I think so.
But Jefferson Bethke says the church resists the technology at its peril.
The importance of YouTube, the importance of the internet is huge for the next coming generation of the church. We need to be able to utilize that, and we need to be able to infiltrate that realm to be able to actually impact the next coming generation.
Which Bethke is wasting no time in doing. He recently posted a video on sex and marriage. It has more than 3 million hits. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Our program is directed by Monica Evstatieva, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Brendan Banasak. The technical director is Stu Rushfield, and we get engineering support from Chris Nelson.
At the arts desk, Laura Bertrand, Tom Cole, Sarah Saracen, and Felix Contreras. National desk staff includes Steve Drummond, Les Cook, Marilyn G. Wax, Quinn O'Toole, Ken Barkas, Andrea De Leon, Amy Walters, and Marisa Peñalosa.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
When it comes to the home video release of TV shows, most of the attention goes to the newest seasons of the newest shows. But our TV critic, David Bianculli, says there's gold to be found in the first-time DVD releases of a couple of older TV programs. One is a 1970 edition of The David Susskind Show, and the other is an onstage reunion in 1996 of Sid Caesar and his legendary writers.
The two DVDs I want to talk about today are hilarious.
But they aren't sitcoms. They're talk shows. Well, one's a talk show, and one's a film seminar. But they're both fascinating examples of a specific pop culture moment frozen in time. And there's something else as well. Both of them are highly entertaining real-time examples of talk show Darwinism. Both shows feature a large, unwieldy guest roster, all of the guests competing for attention at the same time. And by the time the programs are over, the winners are apparent. The first DVD, from Samore Entertainment, is a 1970 installment of The David Susskind Show, a syndicated talk show. The topic of this particular program, never before released on home video, was How to Be a Jewish Son. And the guests fielding questions from Susskind included actor George Siegel, who had just come out with the movie Where's Papa, writer Dan Greenberg, author of the then-recent bestseller How to Be a Jewish Mother, and Jewish entrepreneurs from the fashion and fast food industries. But the breakaway stars, the guests who ended up running away with the show and taking it over almost completely, were David Steinberg and Mel Brooks. Steinberg had just played an unintentional part in the firing of the Smothers Brothers on CBS, and Mel Brooks had mounted the original movie version of The Producers. No matter the topic, these two were hot. And even when one of them was asked a question by Susskind, the other was just as likely to respond. And the responses, for the time, are almost shockingly candid. Here's Steinberg, the son of a rabbi, and at the time very much a single young man, answering one of the host's questions about dating outside his faith. But when Susskind asks Steinberg a follow-up question, the reply comes from Mel Brooks instead.
Well, it's hard to bring a Gentile girl home to a Jewish family. What you do is you bring home a black girl first.
By way of breaking the ice.
Then you bring home the Gentile girl. Yeah. And then you're, they say, oh, come on in. It's a nice thing to eat. Would you like something to eat? They say, Mary Smith, sit down. See, that's chul, like in Hanukkah.
Seriously, have you brought Gentile ladies into your household?
No,
Your father being a rabbi.
Do you know in a Jewish religion, if you're going with a Jewish girl, if you're just engaged to her and you break off, you still pay alimony? You know that?
I didn't know.
Legal.
That's legal.
Sure, three kisses and, and alimony. Alimony. It's not a lot. There is a token, like 80% of you.
In your bachelorhood, you must have paid a lot of alimony.
Oh, in my bachelorhood, did I pay alimony? There was a girl in Scranton, I gotta tell you.
The David Susskind Show was televised for 28 years, and How to Be a Jewish Son was its most famous and most requested installment. And now it's here. The other DVD is a reunion of the writers who had worked with Sid Caesar, either on 1949's Admiral Broadway Review or his two 1950s TV classics, Your Show of Shows and Caesar's Hour. There are no clips from those shows on this DVD. What there is, though, is priceless. Unlike an edited version shown years ago on public TV, this is the entire two-hour seminar, in which 10 very smart men sit on stage in folded chairs and tell their stories while telling jokes at the same time. What a panel. Lucille Callan, who wrote for Your Show of Shows, isn't there. Neither is Woody Allen, who wrote for some of Caesar's TV specials. But my, look who is. Not only Sid Caesar and his writing co-star Carl Reiner, but writers Neil Simon and his brother Danny, Larry Gelbart, good old Mel Brooks again, and others whose names are less familiar but whose one-liners here are just as funny. And that's what I love most about this freewheeling two-hour discussion. It's comedy at its most democratic, just as in a real TV writer's room. It doesn't matter who offers up the best joke, funny wins. And all the others are smart enough to know funny when they hear it and laugh generously when it arrives. Here's a perfect example. Sid Caesar is describing the weekly budget for Your Show of Shows when one of the less famous veteran writers, Sheldon Keller, throws in an ad-lib that delights everyone, including Caesar.
The first Show of Shows cost an hour and a half, everything, all the writers, everything cost $64,000 a week for the entire show.
I saw the same show in Kmart for $28,000.
And right after that, someone else scores too.
It's Mel Brooks, who clearly thrives in these highly competitive, joke-filled environments.
I belong to Sid. I didn't belong to the show. I didn't belong to Max Liebman.
That's right.
I belong to Sid.
You and still do, don't you?
Yeah, and Sid. And Sid could call me night or day, and sometimes he'd wake me at 3:30 in the morning and say, Mel, Sid, need a joke. Okay. What is it? Carrots. Okay, carrots. I ate so many carrots I couldn't sleep. He said, why not? I could see through my eyelids. Carrots. Oh, carrot. Joke. Carrot.
That's the beauty and the equality of comedy. No matter who comes up with the joke, funny is funny. And so are How to Be a Jewish Son and Caesar's Writers.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching. He reviewed two new DVDs, Caesar's Writers, which was recorded in 1996 by the Writers Guild West, and How to Be a Jewish Son, a 1970 episode of The David Susskind Show. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Now let's go from scientific discoveries to a rapidly emerging market, China, which has a consumer market that is massive, 1.3 billion people. Breaking into that market is not easy. Some products from the United States, like donuts, have not done so well. But an old American sneaker has become a success. The Converse Chuck Taylor All-Star, which you may just call Chucks. NPR's Frank Langford explains how a cheap canvas basketball shoe became popular in the Middle Kingdom.
I'm walking along a side street in Shanghai around lunchtime. There are a lot of people out. And there's a woman walking along here wearing a pair of raspberry-colored Chuck Taylors. In fact, in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I've seen two other people wearing Chuck Taylors as well.
The girl with the raspberry sneakers is Xu Jing. She's a 27-year-old who works for an ad company. I ask her why she likes the shoes.
They have a young image, upbeat and outdoorsy, sporty. Young people with an artistic sense prefer Converse.
Chen Xiaolei, Xu's co-worker, owns three pairs of Chuck Taylor high tops.
The shoes are pretty light, good-looking. They go with skinny jeans. Nowadays, young people like these shoes because they're fashionable.
Yes, fashionable. The canvas and rubber shoe that dates to 1917 Massachusetts is now considered reasonably cool among 20-somethings in Shanghai. Last year, about 5 million pairs of Chuck Taylors were sold in China, not counting all the fakes. It's not a huge number in this giant market, but it's up 50% from 2007. To understand the shoe's emerging popularity here, it's worth looking at how its image has morphed over time. The Chuck Taylor spent its first decades as a hoop sneaker.
Wilt Chamberlain has the shot at a 100-point game tonight. He's already broken his own record of 78 points in a game.
Then, in the 1970s, punk rockers adopted the shoe. The Ramones wore Chuck Taylors. As did Kurt Cobain of Nirvana in the 1990s. The shoe finally arrived in China in 1993, and Chinese rockers followed the fashion lead of American groups they admired. Yang Haisong sings with the Beijing indie band PK14. He's been wearing Chuck Taylors for years. Yang thinks they're popular because of their price and image.
It's quite cheap compared to other like Nike, like Adidas, and the second one, the reason is like it's people like to look back.
Fugu means retro in Chinese, and Chuck Taylors can sell for as little as $35 a pair, cheap by current standards. Until relatively recently, Converse licensed its brand here to a Taiwanese company that marketed the shoes as sportswear. In 2007, Converse took the brand back and began emphasizing a more casual, youthful image.
I'm Steve Parker. I'm the VP GM of Converse Asia Pacific.
Parker says the company partnered with street artists and built on existing influential customers like Yang Haisong. Converse underwrote a tour for PK14 and another Chinese band, Queen C Big Shark.
We put them on a bus and we traveled through, I think it was 9 different provinces, and it ended up in a big party and a show in Beijing right at the time of the Olympics.
Converse still gives Yang Haisong and his band free sneakers. But it also gets marketing help from people with whom it has no relationship. Kenny Lee runs MyT in Shanghai. It's a Converse store / museum with no connection to the company. Lee says he carries 1,300 different Chuck Taylors, including limited editions from Tokyo and New York. He shows me a two-tone shoe that fuses styles from the 1960s and the 1980s. I ask how much it costs.
This pair is priceless. Many people offered me $1,500 or $3,000, and I wouldn't sell. No matter how much money you offer, I'm not going to sell.
A potential customer, Ju Ling Ling, walks in and looks at a fur-lined Chuck Taylor. Ju used to wear the brand as a college student. She now designs cosmetics packaging and recently had a child.
Now that I work, I don't wear these shoes as often, but sometimes I still want to chase the memories of my college days.
Kenny Lee wants $160 for the shoes. Ju says she loves them, especially the fur, but can't see paying that much for nostalgia. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.